I can't believe another month has gone past. Hello, good evening, welcome to the August edition of On the Front Foot, our cricket chat show here at Suzy 103.4. We're very excited about all our guests this evening. If you like, you can email us at studio@suzyradio.com, S-U-S-Y radio, all one word. You can ping us a text to 07480 025010. And my colleague Tim Bowling is going to do his level best to keep an eye on our Twitter feed, so you can always try tweeting us at Suzy Radio. I'm absolutely delighted to tell you that along with his colleague from Sevenoaks School, our regular pundit Jim Grant, Chris Taveray of Kent, Somerset and England is going to be our first test playing guest on the show in a little while from now. Our first guest is John Hall from Outwood, who are having a very successful season. And without more ado, let me say good evening to Tim Bowling.
Good evening, David. How are you?
It's what you always ask me, my friend, and as far as I'm concerned, I'm absolutely fine. A little bit warm in here, and yes, we might just possibly, I suppose, fall foul of the noise of the aircon, but let's hope we don't do
that. I'm sure we'll be fine.
John Hall from Outwood Cricket Club, it's absolutely brilliant to have you back at Suzy 103.4.
Thank you very much, David.
How are you, and how are things?
Yeah, pretty good. I'm in fine fettle, and the club's doing well, so all must be good.
And still taking the field in white clothing yourself?
I do, yes. A lot of people can't believe that, but I do. And I'm looking after the second 11 these days.
Yes, well, we'll need to ask you a bit about that, because obviously it's not just Outwood Firsts who are going along very well. I remember when you were here with us the time before, you were telling us all about the gradual success of your youth schemes and policies at Outwood, and fairly clearly, Tim, those are starting to bear fruit in terms of the results that Phil Yent sends me. Phil is one of my most reliable correspondents for the Wednesday results.
It sounds like both teams chasing promotion at the moment, so it sounds like things are going well at Outwood.
Yeah, they're going very well. It's amazing how youngsters improve from one year to the next when they're around about 14, 15, and our 14-year-olds last year have been transformed this year.
We've been, as I say, looking at your results on a weekly basis, and you've obviously got through that first generation now of quality home-produced students being away at university.
Just about, yes. There's still one or two who are still away for part of the season, but one of the reasons we're doing so well is that a lot of them are now back and taking part in the whole season rather than just the second half as happened before.
And judging by the results that Phil's been sending in to me, the runs have been raining down. There have been hundreds right, left and centre.
They have indeed, yes. I mean, the weather's obviously partly to thank for that, because runs come very quickly at Outwell once you've got yourself in on that good wicket.
I'm sure that's the case, and we might ask you a little bit of detail about that later on, but just tell us very quickly where the first and second 11s at Outwood are in respect of the league positions.
Well, the first team are top of Division 2 and pressing very hard for promotion into Division 1, which is obviously the division to be in the Kent Village League. The second team are at the moment, I think, second in Division 7. We're pressing hard for promotion. I'm quietly confident, but there are about four or five teams there or thereabouts, so it's not a done deal yet.
This may be a daft question, but it's based on the way in which in Sussex they're now mixing up the first and second 11s of the big clubs in the top few divisions. So East Grinstead Seconds, for example, are playing in the Division 3 East in Sussex, while the first 11 are in the Premiership. Is it possible in the KVCL for a second team to end up in the same division as their senior team?
I don't believe it is, no. I think that would prevent you from being promoted.
Clearly that would be a fairly nonsensical situation, but I just wondered whether it was laid down anywhere. Well, let's go back to front in that case, John, and tell us about the progressive fortunes of your virtually all-conquering second team.
Well, I mean, as I may have said last year when I was on the programme, we had a very good crop of under-14s who it was probably a year early for them to actually come into the second 11 at adult league cricket. But they've grown, got bowl faster, catch everything in the field, and as under-15s, they're really more than holding their own. And they'll be pushing for first 11 places very soon.
I saw the names Marcus Malley and Drew Tunstall mentioned in last week's report.
Yeah, they're two of our best players. Marcus actually is a little bit old. He's only 17. He and his father moved to the village over the winter, so they were a very lucky find for us. But Drew's been one, along with several others, who's been coming through really well and improves almost with every game.
And of course there are others. It's very difficult for us on a Wednesday afternoon to do more than mention those who've got figures of some kind, because we're jamming an awful lot into 2 minutes and three quarters twice over in a two-hour show. But obviously there are others. Are there any other... I don't want to put you in an invidious position, but is there anybody else at the moment among your junior second team regulars who you'd single out for praise?
I don't want to single them out too much, because there are a number, but I mean Lucas Evans has been a good player for a long time, and is making really good progress. His brother Max actually hasn't played a lot of cricket, and I think Lucas has probably dragged him along, and Max is making really good progress. So those are certainly two to look out for.
And what about the more venerable members of the side?
You're looking at me there, David. I think every year I think, can I manage one more season? And I go to nets and I manage to get it down the other end and hit a few balls. So I keep going. I think my brain is worth a lot on the field, even if my body isn't.
Yeah, believe you me, you're a great deal less venerable than I. And I'm afraid I saw the finishing tape and hung everything up, including now my umpiring white coat as well. It's just all sort of slipped away. But I think it is use it or lose it, isn't it? You need to keep going. I think once you stop...
I think that's right, but actually I still enjoy it. And on the rare occasion the youngsters don't do it and I'm called on, I can still contribute, which is the main thing.
Do you find that the youngsters fit well into the side in terms of they're not intimidated by the opposition and they're able to sort of cope with adult cricket if they're used to playing in Colts cricket?
I think initially, they're not surprisingly, they find a bit nervous because they don't know what to expect. They're expecting lightning fast bowlers, and once they start playing and they realise that most of the quick bowlers are their age, then they get over it pretty quickly and they grow into it very, very quickly.
Yeah, I think it's amazing how quickly, when you play with these youngsters, how quickly they do adapt to the sort of senior cricket and the whole sort of ethos. I don't know whether there's much sort of sledging and such like in the Kent Village League, but in certainly in the Surrey Championship there's a fair degree of that, and the youngsters I've played with seem to handle that pretty well.
Yeah, in the lower divisions, and certainly my team, I try to discourage it because I'm an old fogey, but there's not very much, to be honest. In the higher divisions a bit more, but I don't think it's anything like the Surrey Championship.
Can you remind, this is for me personally, because I think you explained this last time you were here, the reason Outwood are in the Kent League as opposed to the Surrey League, or because Outwood's technically is in Surrey, isn't it?
It is a Surrey
club. You play in the
right.
Kent County Village. You did explain this last time, but I can't remember what you said, so it's for my own benefit.
I'm not 100% sure, but I believe the reason is before we went into league cricket, we were playing the sorts of clubs who now are in the Kent Village League. So we're talking about the Chiddingstones and the Lye and clubs sort of on the way to Tunbridge Wells. And then when they all joined a Village League, we had the choice of joining them or staying friendly, which wasn't an option when anyone else is joining a league. And so we decided to stay with that league, really.
And they're quite pretty grounds that you play at. And
they're very nice. I mean, this year I've played several of the villages up the Darrant Valley north of Sevenoaks, and they're all beautiful grounds.
Yeah.
And you don't play on the recreation grounds that you might do in Surrey.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of the Surrey Championship games, when you go down to the sort of second and third 11, you're playing in sort of, well, some recreation parks in London and so forth, and it's not always the prettiest grounds to play at, which certainly can put some people off wanting to play. So.
John, you mentioned Chiddingstone and so on. Any particular favourites of your own?
I always like playing on Lye Village Green. I think that's a lovely sort of setting. But I played this year for the first time at Ainsford, which is right next to the River Downs, and that's a delightful ground, a real sort of typical English village ground. So those are probably up there with my favourites, I think.
I must remember saying that donkeys years ago, when we used to have the occasional night out at a hostelry called the Plough in Powder Mill Lane, just out of the back of where Lye Cricket Club plays, we'd often come home that way afterwards, and incredibly impressive. I mean, we're talking 1970s here for a village ground with a pavilion balcony. Absolutely extraordinary. Anyway, you're in pole position. It's going to, is it four games to go now, or five to go, so that's going to be a potential real scrap, isn't it?
It is, because the second 11 actually play nearly all of the other teams we play are in the top five. I think we've only got one, what you might call an easy game, but none of them, of course, are easy. But so, yeah, they're all big games, as I keep telling them. I think the team are fed up with hearing this is a big game this week, but I'm afraid it is true.
It's very important, I think, that you insist on that. I mean, Hawley, who have been going well in the Fullers, promptly went and declared on 2:30 odd and lost to the bottom side Frimley last Saturday. So there's really no such thing as a bottom side. And also in the Fullers, Newdigate overturned the leaders, St John Grammarians. So I'm sure you're absolutely right about that. Can we turn our attention, John, if we may, to the first team's progress? But just before we do, there's one mandatory question which Tim and I have set everybody from every club who's come in this season, because back in February, was it, we went to the local Umpires Association presentation on the new laws, and in actual fact, in our first show of the year, Howard Cohen, who is the Southeast Regional Education Officer for the Umpires Association, was sitting in the chair where you're sitting now. Have the new laws impinged in any way, shape or form whatsoever on second team cricket at Outwood?
On second team cricket, no, I don't think they have, no.
You don't surprise me. Presumably you're in the situation in Division 7 where you have player umpires.
Normally, yes. Yeah. We try and get independent ones, but normally it's players.
Which makes it then very, very difficult indeed, when probably a lot of said player umpires aren't even conversant.
No,
with
that's it. I mean, even being, when we went to that presentation in the winter, it was, well, some of the new laws were very complicated to try and work out, even for proper umpires, let alone players who've probably not glanced at the law book for some time.
It wasn't entirely clear whether those giving the presentation were 101%, but anyway, there we are. Right then, John, Outwood first, how are they doing?
They're doing very well. They're top of the league. Last week they were top of the league by some distance, and then they had an unfortunate game against Southborough where the game was abandoned fairly early on due to the pitch being dangerous, and potentially that deprived us of 10 points, which may or may not prove to be important at the end of the season.
I suppose that would have been a case at somewhere like Southborough of heavy rain at last overnight on the Friday night and hard underneath.
I think that's right, and the grounds were not having any chance to get on it after the rain.
So does that mean that the match is abandoned, then it's shared points then?
It is, yeah, 10 points each.
Wow, I would have thought it would have been much fairer for if it's, especially if it's the home ground, which is unplayable, that you would get the win.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, I don't know whether there'll be any sort of further thinking on that from the league, but certainly at the moment it's 10 points each.
Right.
And the law is the law. I mean, everybody signs up to it at the start of the season, so there it is. I always liked Southborough with the church and the village green. I know there's the main road there as well, but
I think if you're standing near the road looking away from it, it's absolutely delightful. The traffic's a bit noisy, but I'm sure you get used to it, and it does have great character.
Do you play Speldhurst, which is virtually over the fence from Southborough?
I have played Speldhurst, yes. That's a sort of a recreation ground, but a nice one, actually.
I only ask because an ex-colleague of mine at the grammar school is now head of Skinner's School at Tunbridge Wells, and he lives in Speldhurst, and he's playing for them, but haven't had the chance to go and have a look yet. And Bidborough was the other place, and I'm talking late 60s when Tav was a boy, you know. I can remember going to Bidborough and thinking that it was a day out. It's extraordinary how times change, really, isn't it? You know, to go to somewhere between Tunbridge and Tunbridge Wells in those days really was an excursion.
Long way, yes, that's right. Yeah.
So, first chasing promotion, and a number of people seem to have shared the laurels in the first 11, John.
Yes, I think so. I mean, we've been lucky in getting one or two new players in who've all been very promising, and all of our young sort of 20-year-olds, they've all got talent and ability, and on any one day a different one takes it in turns to get the runs or the wickets.
It's good to see it being shared around when I'm doing my my Wednesday roundup. And of course, Outwood appear to have taken to the Surrey Slam, whose organiser we had in that chair earlier in the season too. Outwood Outlaws really seem to have taken to the Slam with bells on.
They have. It's almost a competition designed for our sort of youngsters, actually, because what we've done, we've combined the best young players of the first team with the very promising 15-year-olds in the second team, so that the oldest player is 23 years of age, which is a bit younger than in the second team, and they've absolutely gelled and thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think what we've seen is the first team of a few years' time developing together in that competition.
And of course T20 is what the youngsters are used to playing from Colts level up, so I suppose there's every reason to anticipate a degree of expertise certainly at that level. And I believe there was a memorable final group match against the local rivals South Nutfield.
Well, we always have close encounters against South Nutfield, and that was no exception. But, you know, when two teams want to win badly, then these things can happen from time to time.
And I'd imagine Outwood is quite a sight when the pavilion's full and there's lots of spectators.
It is, and we've really entered into the spirit of things, because we've somebody's put on some music, so you know, when there's a four runs or a wicket falls, then the disco blasts out, which I know is not to everyone's taste, but the youngsters do enjoy that.
Now it's the Llamas next in a very few days from now. How do you think that's going to work out?
We're ready. We'll have the same team we've had. It'll be interesting to see whether the Llamas strengthen their side in a way, because obviously they have the ability to do that. But, you know, never mind. We are what we are, and we're going to give it a good shot.
That's the regional final, isn't it, that you're playing?
It is, Reigate that's Priory, right, yeah. It's actually being played at Merstham,
okay,
but against Reigate Priory, yeah.
Tim, Matt Camp actually implied that the relatively few Premiership clubs who are involved in the Slam would receive a fairly strong mandate not to select first team players, because if I'm right, the original purpose of the Slam was to encourage people back into playing cricket at all. Yeah. It wasn't intended as competition
exactly.
On that basis.
I mean, as we know from what Matt said, the competition has grown in popularity massively over the last two seasons, so it will be interesting to see whether Reigate Priory turn up with a side which is well, let's say, better than it might be, shall we say.
You just wish Reigate Priory would turn up on the front foot occasionally.
They don't seem
to want to talk to us at all, which is very, very strange, given that they're the leading club and, of course, top of the Premiership. Although that extraordinary drawn game last Saturday, which we'll be talking about later on, no doubt, at home against Ashton, means that Weybridge close in again. It's only 10 points now at the top.
Yes, so, very close at the top, yes.
So, indeed. Now, last time you were here, I think I'm right, John, in saying that we were discussing the very sad loss of Phil Alexander. But there's something for you to tell us about as regards that recent May Bank holiday.
Yeah, well, we had a memorial game in Phil's name involving, two games of cricket, actually. One fairly competitive, which Phil liked to do. He was first team captain. But Phil was a great social cricketer as well. So we had a second game, which was purely for social cricketers. We had well over 100 people there, I think. It was a good, really good turnout. Luckily, fantastic weather. And one of the local artisans in the village has carved a wooden gate, which we now call the Alexander Gate, and it's at the top of the ground. And it's a work of art, actually. If anyone walks their dog past there, they can look at it, and that's what it's all about.
We'll have to try and make sure we get a picture and pop it on our website at some point, especially if, you know, these two promotion slots are achieved. That would be a tremendous tribute to Phil as well, wouldn't it, if that were to happen?
It would, because, you know, Phil was a good cricketer, but he wasn't one of the best. But what he did do, he introduced real enjoyment of the game, which is key, and one reason I think that our club is buzzing as it is today.
Good clubmen don't have to be brilliant cricketers necessarily, do they? No. It's about those who are prepared to roll their sleeves up and make things happen. Now, Ian Milton was your club captain. Tell us about his son, Alex.
Yeah, well, Alex, I remember him playing as a sort of 11, 12-year-old, and everyone said, boy, this fellow's going to go places. He's just graduated from Cardiff University MCC School of Excellence. He was awarded a county contract with Worcester, I think, earlier this year, or when he graduated, at least. And he made his debut last week, I think, against Somerset. I happened to be in Worcester, actually, by fortune, really, because I didn't know he was playing. And I saw the first innings. He apparently kept brilliantly, three dismissals and no byes. Who's the two Somerset bowlers, the two brothers? Overton's.
Yeah.
They were a bit fierce in the first innings, and he got eight runs and did okay. But in the second innings, he got his maiden first-class century and set a new 10th wicket record for Worcester. So that was rather impressive.
Isn't it amazing, though, with players like that you see even from an early age, you can pick out the fact that they are just a class above even the better players at the club?
Yes, it's partly talent, but I think it's more than that. It's attitude, yeah, and
dedication,
just the fact that they've got their brain together, yeah, and that's what makes them stand out, I think.
John, like some clubs, but not all that many, you've been successful as well, not just in involving girls in your academy, in your junior cricket, but you've got a Pucker ladies' side.
We have, yes. I mean, they're enjoying their cricket very much. I think they certainly last year they played in the league. I'm not 100% sure if they're playing league or friendly, but they're lining up another league to play in next year. And they're there every Wednesday with everybody else practicing, and, you know, good turnouts, and they enjoy their cricket.
Well, there's the promise of a ladies' Surrey Slam for 2019.
Next year there's a thing. It's not called the Surrey Slam. It's called the something similar.
There's the Smash It
indoor
thing,
indoor,
isn't,
yeah,
there?
Oh, okay, that's right.
But I've got a feeling they're looking to actually replicate the slam out of doors as well.
Yeah.
And you are looking now to replicate your academy success, and the next generation is there or thereabouts of young juniors?
Yes, we go all the way down to seven. I'm working with the under-9s on a Thursday, and there's a very good group there. I think that they might be our next large group to come through, but there's several in between, and we've just got to develop them all and feed them one by one into the adult teams.
Youth policy is what it's all about.
Yeah.
This, you know, from my own experience, is where wandering sides like the one I played for can come off the rails, because there is no natural progression as there is in a club that's got a clubhouse and a home set up and all the rest of it. John, we always say on this show that time flies when you're having fun. Anything else you'd like to tell us about as regards Outwood for this visit?
Not really. I mean, as I say, it's all going well. If anyone wants to see some exciting T20 cricket, we're at Merstham on Monday, and that'll be a fun occasion, I think, and certainly there's a big contingent from Outwood going. So
yes, there's a lot going on in the next couple of days as regards Merstham. There's the league on Saturday, there's the commemorative match against Banstead tomorrow night, the 100th anniversary of the last match before the commencement of the First World War, and then, as you say, there's the slam. So Tim rushes back from London to be on this show, but I might put myself about a little bit over the weekend and next week. We shall see. John Hall from Outwood Cricket Club, it's always an absolute delight to see you in the studio here at On the Front Foot. We wish you well with those promotion pushes in both divisions, and we look forward to you coming back and seeing us again soon.
Thank you very much.
For various reasons, I thought it was entirely appropriate to come into the second section of tonight's show. In fact, it's an extended section. We're going to be together now all the way through. But I thought it was appropriate to come in with Sol Limbo, not because it's the theme tune nowadays to a rather longer-running cricket radio show than ours, but because back in the 1980s, it was the theme to BBC television cricket when everything was on terrestrial screens and all was right with the world. It's a very long time ago, although perhaps I shouldn't say that with our principal guest sitting opposite me. First and foremost, Jim Grant, good evening, welcome back.
Good evening.
And Jim, what we're going to do is concentrate for a while on our honoured guest, of whom more in just a moment, and then probably in the last half hour of the show we'll broaden out into some of the issues of the day and so on, which sure. The four of us can discuss. But it's an absolute delight now to welcome to Suzy 103.4 Chris Tavaray of Kent, Somerset and England, Sevenoaks School, Oxford University. Chris has been through the mill. Chris, it's an utter pleasure to have you here. Good evening.
Good evening. Thanks for having me here.
Well, it's our privilege to have you, and perhaps we can start off with Sevenoaks, where you and Jim have been colleagues for many years. I don't actually know, so let me ask. We were speculating before we started. Have you hung the chalk up and the coach's hat?
Yes, I've finally retired. That's about 4 weeks ago now. So after 24 years of teaching, everything caught up with me a bit, and
I thoroughly recommend the retirement bit. How many years did you run the first team at Sevenoaks ish?
I was coaching the first team for about 20 years, maybe a bit less. I ran the cricket for 20.
Yeah.
And towards the end, I decided I would go and help with the sort of under 15s, under 14s, try and really get them into the ways of playing. We want them to be demonstrating before they actually reach first team level. So
now Jim, of course, worked for both you and for me as masters in charge of cricket, and we, between the two of us, we got the best part of 25 years, you know, it's getting up towards 50 years between us of being masters in charge of cricket. That's quite a lot of service, isn't it, when you stop and think about it. I'm not going to ask Jim to draw comparisons, because I was a jobbing village green Sunday afternoon wandering cricketer and you played for England. Chris, can we go back to the start? Obviously, you're Sevenoaks through and through, but what about before Sevenoaks? Does a pro cricketer like yourself have some sort of a road to Damascus moment at the age of 7, 8, 9 and decide that he wants to really take cricket seriously?
No, certainly not. I mean, I think when I was very young, I was more interested in being a England footballer than an England cricketer. And I think it was probably not until sort of perhaps when I was at university I realised it was a possibility. But even then, you know, I can't remember actually making a decision as to, you know, I had choices and which way I was going to go. I just naturally seemed to go into cricket.
From my own perspective, I mean, being local, being an old Cateramian, and I mean, I was at the university which we were privileged to share as undergraduates, but you're a few years behind me on the old ladder of time. So by the time I was in the middle of being an undergraduate and one of my best younger friends was skippering Caterham, I remember vividly, we've got to go to Sevenoaks and see Tavaray bat, because you're selling yourself a little bit short, I think, about not knowing. You were pretty much a schoolboy prodigy, weren't you, at Sevenoaks? You scored an awful lot of runs.
More towards the end. I mean, it took time to establish. You know, I started very young in the side. But my last 2 years, I was certainly starting to dominate and getting into the Vine first team, which in those days was really the route into cricket, rather than through the sort of age groups that there are now and academies. So, yeah, by the time I was sort of 17, I was starting to get to the top level of club cricket anyway.
And were there figures at the Vine who played second, first team cricket for Kent then?
There were one or two who had played. Paul Downton's father, George Downton, used to keep wicket. Alan Hurd, who both Jim and I worked with at Sevenoaks School, was taught English, but he came after 3 years with Cambridge and Essex. was very much a sort of inspirational figure as far as my own career was concerned. It was a very high standard, and the Kent League had started in probably the early 70s, and I certainly remember we won the league, I think it was 1972, on the back of probably three or four spinners in the side, you know, people round the bat, things you just don't see so much now.
I'm sure we'll come on to that, Tim, a bit, quite a lot later on. To put this in perspective, you were just shy of 2,800 runs for Sevenoaks First 11 in four seasons. That's an awful lot of runs for a schoolboy, isn't it? And according to what's in front of me, you made 187 not out as your top score for the school. So please don't sell yourself short on that. Do you think, we'll go round and round in circles here a little bit, but do you think in latter days, you're talking about yourself playing at the Vine all those years ago, what do you think about the school first 11 versus premiership club debate? No names, no pack drill, but there's certainly one lad who's just finished at the grammar school in Reigate who's in the Priory first team, and I'm not sure that's always an easy situation. I mean, I think back to Gregor Kennis at Tiffin and people like that, and even Nick Faulkner and Andy Babington with me in the old days. What do you think about that? Does it benefit them more to stay with the school, or are they better off playing first team cricket in the leagues?
Well, our attitude has been, you know, a mix is a good thing. I mean, I think nowadays if you have a young player with any aspirations to make it to the top, you know, they need to be playing a mix of dominating their own age groups, but at the same time being tested by older, more experienced players. And so our view, you know, will be that, you know, if someone has really got to that stage, say in the lower six, we might have discussions with their club as to whether we let them go for a game or two on a Saturday, making sure they're available for our big games. But I think you have to do really what's in the best interest of that boy or girl, as it case may be, so that they can achieve if they have those sorts of ambitions.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, looking back, and it is such a long time ago, but when you were starting out on your pro career was when we had Nick Faulkner and Andy Babington at Reigate at the same time. And it was a bit different in those days because you had Surrey young cricketers rather than this great ladder of progression. And Mike Edwards, who looked after the YCs at that stage, was very, very good with the schools because he would always say to us, look, there are so many YC's games that if you've got important games after the exams, let them play for you, and there'll be plenty of other games they can play for us. And then, of course, Nick and Alex Stewart from Tiffin went on and progressed very quickly into what was, I think, Esca in those days, and on up the ladder. Yeah, you were a bit of a trailblazer, Chris, if I'm right, and I'm not sure whether Tash Farrant was the first, but you were a bit of a trailblazer with girls cricket at Sevenoaks, which is to say, mixed cricket at Sevenoaks. I remember coming down to see Jim. Tash wouldn't remember, but I remember speaking to her on the boundary. And I think I'm right in saying that I've umpired down there relatively recently, and Tash was playing in that game as well. So tell us a little bit about the involvement of the girls with a traditional boys set-up as was.
Well, when I first arrived at Sevenoaks, that was sort of mid-90s, we actually had a girls' team, who played quite a few fixtures against other schools midweek, and then as sort of staff changed, with so many sports you're dependent on having staff prepared to take particularly non sort of conventional games, lesson sports, so once they gave up the cricket, we started to sort of take the girls who wanted to play cricket into the boys' teams. I mean, part of the problem during those early years was that a lot of the good cricketers were good tennis players, and you were constantly dragging them, you know, and probably asking them to do too much. So it's worked well where girls who want to play cricket, and because we have at sort of junior and under 14, 15 level B teams, if some girls are happier at that level and do very well, and we've got one or two who've progressed like Tash Farrant, we currently have a girl who's just come through year 11. She plays for Sussex, and she's played quite a few games in the first team. So, you know, we're very keen to encourage that. But this year we've gone back to our head of girls' games, Liz Joseph, decided there was a place for girls to, you know, playing girls' teams. And so in the junior school this year, she's restarted the girls' cricket as a independent from the boys, but some of them will play both for those sides and the mixed sides.
We certainly find there are problems with local clubs, girls particularly, but boys also. It's the transition from the Colts T20 and perhaps a slightly longer form to getting into the men's or adults side. There's a girl playing in the first team. Craig Stevenson was here from Tadworth, Tim, the other week.
That's right,
and
yep.
They've got two brothers and a sister all playing in the first team there. Took 9 wickets between them last Saturday. Yep. The afternoon, and the girl whose name slips my mind at the moment certainly took 4 of those wickets. But there is this problem of the step from the very short form to the longer form, and this is Andy Pearson all those years ago, Jim, saying to me, trouble is life's so short and cricket takes so long. But am I right in thinking that Natasha was a slow left armer to start out?
No, she was always a left arm seamer, and she broke through into the first team in year 11 and made such rapid progress. I mean, you wouldn't have predicted it. But
did she stand out for you initially when you first saw her? You thought she's going to be something special?
No, I mean, like so many players at that age, you think she's very good, she'll certainly do well at A-team level. But it wasn't really till year 11 and she started playing in the first team and started to really actually clean up one or two very good batsmen, because she swung the ball and being left arm over gave her an advantage that you suddenly realised she'd gone up, you know, a couple of steps in terms of her performance. So by the end of the last 6, she played her first T20 game for England.
Wow.
So it was
amazing. That's
it was
amazing,
a meteoric rise.
Yeah.
And
she was from a cricketing family, wasn't she? Very much brothers and
Both brothers played for the first team. And but I think the thing with Tash that stood out, and you know, no disrespect to the brothers, but she really had that sort of direction in mind. She wanted to go down the county route and be the best she could. And I think a lot of school cricketers, they don't necessarily go down that route. They want to just enjoy the cricket.
Well, that's, you need, I think that's true, isn't it? You need that determination, don't you, to push you. That just, you've got the talent, but you need to be able to push yourself. And that's the difference, isn't it, to get to that top level.
And you need, I think particularly these days, you need the passion and the love of the game. Because now the programmes are starting the winter.
Yeah.
You know, once a week she'd have been going up to Canterbury for coaching. Mm. And the programmes I've seen for training, you know, just at the under sort of 15 level was probably far greater than I ever did as a professional. So unless you love practice, the nets, the training, you know, you're going to find it tough.
Yeah.
I could broaden this out in two directions and get Tim and Jim a little bit more involved and give Tav a rest for a second, but I'm not quite sure which way to go. Let's start off, Jim. Of course, your teaching career began at Gravesend, and you were involved with schools cricket for girls from the very outset.
Yes, the head of PE there was a woman called Anne Stewart, and she was playing for Kent at the time. I think she might have been vice-captain of Kent. She was on the fringe, I think, of the national squad, and we unusually for a girls school had quite a decent square at the school on site and a reasonable grass net, and there was just a bit of a tradition there, and we played indoor cricket as well. I remember taking the girls up to Stevenage, I think it was, for a sort of national indoor cricket competition, and there was a lot of interest, and 2 or 3 that Anne sort of brought on, as we were saying earlier, a mixture of the club and school. She had a, I think it was Maidstone Invicta or Kent Invicta, I can't remember the The name of the club, but she took some of the more promising ones through to play for the women's club as well. It was all a bit more genteel, I think, in those days. There's been an exponential improvement, hasn't there, in women's cricket and the professionalism and the focus and the way it's organised. It was very different then.
It's my favourite thing on Sky Sports, or certainly Sky Sports cricket. I think it's refreshing because it's different and so very different, Jim. I mean, I've been reading the new book about Swanton and Arlott and the social history that their attitudes and their times imply, and things have changed so very much. I mean, some of the Swantonians would probably have been revolving 6 feet down when it's not so very many years back. It's when Paul Harrison was doing the side at Reigate, and I went down to Brighton College, where Alexa, can't think of her second name, was actually teacher in charge of the first 11 at that point. And there was I standing at square leg in a first team match at Brighton College on the first team ground with their lady left armour bowling to our lady number 8 batsman. And I mean, you would never really have thought that was likely to happen back when I'm talking about the Faulkners and the Babingtons and Jim Swanton, although not that I'd necessarily bracket those together. The other thing that I did notice, and I wonder whether when Chris was starting out as a pro cricketer, I wonder whether pro cricket then would have even countenanced in a dream the idea that there would be a franchise Surrey women's team playing at the Oval in a national KSL which has no real affiliation to the county setup, and in which three of the recent South African touring teams are playing, two of whom, that's the South African captain Danny van Niekerk and her fast bowler Marizan Kapp, have just got married. That is an extent, isn't it, of change.
Yeah, yes, put that way, it does feel very different from Gravesend in the early 80s.
Absolutely extraordinary, and in the week of Pride, none the worse for that either.
No,
but
not at all.
Goodness me, how times change. We've got a few minutes. What about YouTube Seven Oaks chaps in particular, schools cricket through the years and those changes in school cricket? And is it the case that independent schools like Seven Oaks and Reigate are really keeping the game alive, particularly with the 16 to 18 bracket?
Well, you're in the best position to answer that, I think, probably.
Well, I think probably what's happened over the years is that the gap has been filled by the clubs. I mean, so if you look at our area, Seven Oaks has got two clubs who run very big junior sections, the Vine and Holmesdale. And so where maybe cricket wasn't available in state schools so much, they're certainly available within the clubs. So on a certainly at the Vine, on a Thursday night, I think it is, a lot of the juniors come in for coaching, and the Vine has a professional coach now who happens to be doing a lot of our one-to-ones at the school as well. And then on a Sunday morning, quite often I'll drive past the Vine and the juniors are playing on the Vine. Yeah. I mean, I would say one difference is all the cricket now for that sort of age group is packed into term time. Mm. Whereas when I grew up during the summer holiday, I mean, you mentioned the Kent schools,
absolutely,
but the Vine had a full programme, as did Holmesdale, of junior cricket. So, you know, you got 6 months of cricket rather than sort of three.
Yeah.
So I think that creates problems.
I wonder if also, I mean, obviously the schools are producing a lot of the talent. They have the facilities and the input and the professionalism, and school sport is on another level from what it was in sort of our day. But I wonder whether those clubs that are thriving at youth level aren't also a little bit sort of middle class in a way. And you know, there was an item, I think, on Test Match Special today about that there are only 8 players of Afro-Caribbean origin, yeah, playing for county cricket now. And I wonder whether it is a problem that state schools, particularly in urban areas, have had their playing field sold off. don't have the resources, and it's, I think that is a shame. I think that's probably, some talent has probably been lost to the game through that.
And I suspect, without wishing to start treading on eggshells, it's certainly our experience locally that teams who are predominantly composed of players from the subcontinent tend to reinforce that, and that the other, you talk about the middle classes, Jim, some of the other clubs possibly don't make as much effort as they might to integrate and get things wider across the That said, our local side just up the road, Merstham, are an absolute shining example of a really integrated side, and they still put four sides out on a Saturday, so I think that's good. What about, very quickly, Chris, Jim, format changes, the demise of declaration cricket, etc., etc.?
Well, you know my views about that. I'm sure I've repeated them many times on this programme. I'm a bit of an old stickler, purist, traditionalist, and I think it is a shame that that pupils in particular schools don't play declaration games anymore on the whole, and it is all limited overs, and I think that takes a dimension away from the game that's very important. But I think you think a bit differently though, Chris, don't you, really?
I do think it's a shame, but I think the problem is you've got so much pressure on exams now, whereas when I first started teaching we had a lot of all day games, you know, taking pupils out of classes so that they can play an all-day game on a Saturday with exams going on throughout virtually the term now. It's very difficult to justify. And I think the other thing is declaration games, you have to have very good bowlers to make it a success. If you can't bowl sides out, the cricket becomes boring. And not long after I took over, we had quite a few draws, and captain came up to me and said, can't we play more limited overs games? Otherwise, you know, if you have a draw each week, and you know, people get bored and they're more likely to put them off. So it's a mixed blessing.
I think it's true in schools, and when I was coaching at Reigate, we quite often, you knew the opposition that would always prefer not to lose.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to stop you there. We've almost filled our first hour. That is indeed 1 hour down, and one more to come on this August edition of On the Front Foot at Suzy 103.4. We'll be straight back with Chris Tavare, Jim Grant and Tim Bowling. And although we promised we wouldn't dissect Chris's career, I think we might widen things out just a little from Sevenoaks School. Welcome back to the second hour of On the Front Foot, the August edition thereof. Tim Bowling and David Jay at the panel, and delighted to say that our guests are Jim Grant, our regular pundit, and Chris Tavare of Kent, Somerset and England. And we're going to get straight back to Chris, because time is going to fly by now, and we've left Sevenoaks behind, Chris. Oxford University, you obviously took things reasonably seriously, because you didn't play much in your final year. You took the exams being the priority, yeah?
I did. I mean, I learnt at school that exams and cricket didn't really mix. So in my last year, you know, I had a pretty indifferent start. As soon as the exams were over, I probably played the best cricket of my school career. And so at university, I felt, although by then I was starting to play county cricket, I just felt I needed to focus on the exams and do the work necessary, because I still wanted to get as good a degree as I could. And then day after my last exam, we were playing the Australians in the parks, which is a bit of a shock.
there were some matches worth seeing. I remember I used to put lectures second to Greenwich and Richards opening for Hampshire in the parks if there was something boring going on in the Taylorian. I managed to give that a miss. Am I allowed, I'm a bit reluctant to ask, am I allowed to ask you about your highest score in the varsity match?
99,
yeah.
Hit a full toss, leading edge, straight to mid-off. But to be honest, it doesn't bother me at all. I mean, what I remember was we won the game.
Yeah. And, which wasn't all that frequent an occurrence in those days. I'm talking just now about schools cricket. Lots of draws between Oxford and Cambridge way back.
Yeah, and this, but the standard was very high. I mean, my first year, you know, one only has to mention Imran Khan, who's now Prime Minister of Pakistan, but he was the star player. He was way above, you know, a lot of us who played county second team and the odd county game before we arrived. But, you know, you saw that he was playing at a different level. Yeah. And so just the experience for me was important because, you know, I was quite naive, even at the sort of 19, 20, and I needed that sort of time probably to mature and sort of get into cricket that way.
Thick Marks was your skipper, of course.
Yeah, so we'd started playing England schools together. A couple of days ago I saw Paul Parker. We'd come through much the same route, playing South. We played South England schools against India, Canterbury. So a lot of people, Alistair Hignall, Graham Mendes, you know, a lot of good cricketers around at that time, and for the universities. So Peter Roebuck was at Cambridge with Alistair Hignall. So it was a good level of cricket, but the nice thing was the opposition brought good size, but they didn't bring their main fast bowler, so we didn't get terrorised.
Was the varsity match the first time you'd played at Lord's?
It was, yeah.
And what was that like?
It was daunting. I mean, it is the most amazing ground. I mean, there wouldn't have been many people watching, but just the fact of being there was, you know, probably made the occasion doubly important. I mean, the university match was a focal point for the season, but, you know, going out onto the outfield and, you know, playing on this magnificent surface in, you know, was probably the one ground you always got atmosphere.
I always wondered why they ripped the outfield up 10 years ago or so and replaced it. It seemed to me it was perfectly good enough as it was. Best outfield in the world, probably. But have you, it's a long time ago to ask, have you any recollections of Imran as a young man and a teammate?
Yeah, I mean, he was in his last year and so probably as young players, he would talk to us more about our approach to the game and what he thought we did well. And, you know, he was very encouraging. And when he bowled fast, even at that age, he was quick. And we won two games. The combined universities were in the Benson Edges Cup in those days. And two great days. We beat Worcester at Cambridge and Northants at Oxford, and obviously Imran played a major part in both victories, and, you know, that was really exciting.
Am I right in thinking that he joined the Pakistan tour to England when he was only 17 and still at RGS Worcester? I think that's right.
Yeah, he was talking about it. There was a very good interview with Mike Atherton.
It's been excellent.
On television. He was talking about that, and obviously he was playing county cricket for Worcester in those days anyway.
So that was Blues cricket, but you were pretty swiftly out of Oxford and down to Canterbury and got yourself established pretty quickly. Rather than talking about your career, which we promised we wouldn't, what was county cricket like in the late 70s and through the 80s, Chris?
I think a much easier, not easier, but less pressured environment than certainly young players have today. I mean, I was very lucky. Kent were at their peak in the 70s, so I played when the test matches were on initially. I mean, the side probably had 7 or 8 internationals. So as much as I didn't perhaps like it at the time, I batted 7 and 8, and whatever I did was just a bonus, and it was a good way to be eased in, rather than probably now I would be shoved in at number three and expected to do well away.
Sorry, was there a lot of, in terms of that being a learning opportunity and a learning curve, was there a lot of post-match, if you were playing away from home, for example, with Kent, was there lots of talk and lots of filtering down of wisdom?
I think that mainly happened sort of during the day, you know, in the dressing room. I mean, players, yes, went out afterwards, but it was probably more sharing alcohol than, you know, sharing wisdom. But, you know, it was, you were very much a team. And I certainly remember my first full year in 78, which coincided with Packer and Kent wanting to sack Underwood and Knott and so on, and actually the team sort of gelled together almost, and you know, the atmosphere, and we were successful. It were just amazing years to be, you know, learning your trade and establishing yourself.
Because Asif went to Packer as well, did he not?
Did, yeah.
And you had Bernard Julian at Kent in those days.
That's right,
yeah.
He played a number of games, but you could only have two. But
yeah,
certainly, I mean, Asif, I learned a lot from Asif about batting, and, you know, in terms of batting at the middle, you know, which is where I think I learned more than in the nets, you know, just watching these players. And he was the best runner between the wickets, and he took the pressure off you, and, you know, a fantastic player. But as our coaches said, don't learn to look to play like him, because he had very unusual technique.
He used to have his hands quite far apart on the bat handle, didn't he?
You'd
never coach a young player to do that, would you?
What was your thoughts, given that you were sort of establishing yourself in the team, what were your thoughts on the whole Packer thing as it sort of played out in front of you?
I think, like most people, even the players who sort of went, it was fairly naive. I mean, I certainly didn't think that the ECB would go to court over it, that it would cause such ill feeling within the counties and to some extent among some players who felt that people were going to Packer and earning big money, you know, which compared to nowadays was, you know, probably much more of a pittance, but, you know, they got paid to go and play, and it certainly disrupted the game. But I don't think, you know, certainly being part of the Kent dressing room, you know, I don't think there was any animosities against our
Did you see it as an opportunity for you to try and push yourself forward and sort of replace players that weren't going to necessarily be considered?
Well, I mean, the thing was, it was in the winter, so the only cricket it really affected were the England tours. So if you look at the England tour of 78 to Australia, both sides were missing a number of top players, so there were much younger sides. But in terms of county cricket, which I was playing at that time, you were still competing, you know, for places with everyone else. The only player who took a year out was Alan Knott, because Paul Downton was coming along, and then I think they shared a year, and then Paul went to Middlesex. So I don't think there were any other opportunities, but certainly at England level, you know, it certainly did open the doors in a way that when I started playing for England, the South African tours opened doors.
Yeah.
So I probably played for England longer than I would necessarily have done. So I was lucky to have those opportunities, because the likes of Gooch had, you know, gone to South Africa.
Was Colin Cowdrey still playing in his dotage when you started?
Yeah, he was just coming towards the end. So I started, my first games were in 1974. And I remember travelling up to Scarborough and he was playing. Jeff Boycott was in the opposition, and so it was really sort of, you know, you were in awe of these sort of stars, and you could just see how good they were against top class bowling. And then obviously in I think it was 75 after he'd been out to Australia, and he was really coming to the end. He scored a brilliant 100 at Canterbury against the Australians. Yeah. Bob Woolmer got 70 or 80, and you know, they beat the Australians with Lilly and pretty much their full attack playing.
Obviously, we lament tremendously the loss of Bob Woolmer at such a young age. Did he show signs as a player of becoming a coaching guru? Was there any evidence of that?
Definitely. He thought outside the box, as they say these days. And in those days, there wasn't the sort of technical coaching that there is now, and so as a junior player he used to pick the brains of the senior players, and I found when I was not feeling comfortable, my hands weren't working well together, I used to ask Bob or Alan Knott or Graham Johnson, were the three I remember speaking to most, you know, about what I could do. And I can remember I'd been I played in 1980, played two games, got dropped, got repicked in 81. And my hands felt really uncomfortable. We were playing at Eastbourne and Bob took me to the nets and we did a few routines and I got 70, I think it was, in that match. Suddenly felt better and that made a difference to the game. You know, my first recall game. So I think, you know, he thought very differently, much more technically. He could make adjustments that weren't in the MCC coaching book. He could, you know, just move your hands here or try this footwork, or, you know, and one or two moves were a bit bizarre, but they worked. And so, yeah, I was very, they were very important people in terms of learning the game.
Jim, I know you, even though you were in Bromley, you were primarily a Surrey man.
I was, because of the nearness of the Oval, really.
Of course, yes. But I was just thinking then, I mean, we remember the players that Tav has mentioned. Graham Johnson, yes. Underrated cricketer.
Yes, yes.
Very underrated, yeah. Cricketer. Did he not open the batting and bowl off?
He bowled off spinners, yeah.
Underrated, and one or two.
I loved, I mean, Woolmer, I enjoyed watching, and he was one of those sort of players who kind of initially, didn't he start as a sort of bowler who batted and then sort of turned himself more into a batsman who bowled a bit? I seem to remember he got a pair in his first test, didn't he, and then was out of the side for a while,
as did Graham Gooch.
I remember you taking a great slip catch at Lord's in I think it might have been the 1978 Benson and the Hedges, yep, Cup final against Derbyshire. I think
that was
it
the only thing I did. I got the wart.
But Woolmer batted, but just like imperiously. Yeah.
You met my father once or twice, Jim. Dad always thought that it was very obvious that Bob Woolmer, as a batsman, had been in the same team as Colin Cowdrey. He thought there was something of the Cowdrey economy, yes, of effort, yes. And he also used to play that little drap, didn't he? That old-fashioned, yeah, sweep. While I mentioned Dad, and this really is blowing my own trumpet, which I'm not wont to do because that's not what this show or this station is all about, but I can remember my father coming in like a dog with two tails very shortly after the two local authorities amalgamated. That was Caterham and Wallingham and Oxted Rural District. And the Cowdreys were at Limpsfield, of course, in those days. And Colin was summoned, as we all know, to the Ashes Tour. Good morning, I'm Cowdrey, said he to Thompson, who was foaming at the mouth when he walked in. But he turned up in Dad's office, because Dad was the chief environmental health officer, and for some reason it was my father who had to sign some certificate or other to allow him to go to Australia. And if ever I saw my father like a dog with two tails, Colin Cowdrey was in my office this afternoon. Yeah, you know, yeah. Wonderful, wonderful times. Yeah, you talk about changes, and we talk here about club cricket. You know, nowadays it's Oxted and Limpsfield. Limpsfield has ceased to exist as an entity,
really,
in its own right. Wow. Tav, while we're talking about Oxted and Limpsfield, we must mention Four Elms.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I was just sitting for the first half hour listening to you and John talking, and suddenly the Kent Village League is mentioned, and here we are in, I don't know if you'd say it's middle Surrey, but certainly well over the border. And again, when I was growing up, a lot of the club players, school players, played for the Villages on a Sunday. And whilst I started at Seal, because of friends, my brother and I, we went down to play for Four Elms in the early 70s, and my younger brother came on after us. And just by chance, I got a note through, and I hadn't realised that this year was their 150th anniversary. And so I've been down a couple of times to watch, and I'm going to go and watch a couple of league games, because they're top of Division 1 by 1 point from Bidborough, and you know, it's going to be a real battle to the end of the year. So I have many fond memories, and the old black and white pictures are fading nicely in the pavilion, I noticed.
Yes, it's rather sad. Jim and I knew a wonderful man at Reigate called Harry Newton, who was our groundsman and professional, and played mainly Sussex seconds and league cricket in the Bolton League and so on and so forth, and he was a bit of a rolling stone. But the one thing I found, I don't know whether any of you have been to Preston Nomad's new accommodation at Fulking, but it's absolutely superb. Spend Karma's money, the same as all the developments at Hove. But where previously you could go to Fulking and there would be Harry Newton with hair in 1961 or whatever it was on the wall, all the old black and white's gone. To be strictly fair, Jim, I think a lot of my memorabilia have found their way into a skip in the pavilion at Reigate.
But,
but that's the way of the world, isn't it? Modernisers tend to think that history begins with them, and why not? If I'm right, and I don't want to get back to schools cricket, but if I'm right, you've got a fair old display of first 11s year by year around the pavilion at Sandmoat.
Yeah, one of the things I did when I first went back, this the old sort of stuffy boards with inscribed team names, and I just felt that needed sort of moving on. And you know, I love photographs of old teams, full stop, and so I sort of made a project where I would go round, going into cellars and lofts at school, yeah, and getting in touch with old boys, and I managed to get pretty well all but three team photos starting in the 1940s. So wow. I got them framed and all that sort of thing. And you know, it's just one of the things I've really enjoyed doing.
And that's a legacy too. That's absolutely superb. I'm with you all the way about that. So, you're established, Chris, at county level. You're called up first for a one-day international, and shortly after that, you find yourself in the full England 11. Before we come on to the match that I really want to ask you about this evening, and then I'm going to hand the general stuff over to Tim for the last half hour. But how was that transition into the England dressing room for you?
Terrifying, actually. I got told, we were playing at Bournemouth, and I was sort of told on the Saturday night, because they always announced it on the radio on a Sunday morning, and you know, it was actually an exception that you knew the night before, but I was told I'd be playing. But it was against the West Indies, and although I'd sort of seen Holding, I hadn't faced him. I'd just started to play a bit against Malcolm Marshall, Joel Garner, and my first game, the one-day game, I remember we turned up, well, our nets were in the afternoon and the West Indies in the morning, and we turned up just as they were finishing, and Holding was in the nets, which were just underneath the changing rooms balcony, and I looked over the balcony, he's bowling off three paces, and I've never seen anything like it. And you just sort of, you know, I mean, the only thing I can describe is the flow of adrenaline as you're waiting to bat was something I'd never experienced before.
So I bet
it was difficult.
I mean, those three bowlers that Chris has just mentioned, Jim, they would grace current cricket, and they would succeed in current cricket. Yeah. I'm interested you say that about Holding. I happened to be in Jersey one spring when Hampshire were out there for a pre-season, and this was at Grainville, Jim, and I was side on pavilion that end, wide open spaces here, and I was side on, and our old friend Ward Jenner walked in to open the batting for Jersey against Hampshire, and Marshall, I suspect not at full split, came in from that pavilion end, and I never saw the ball side on. What I saw was Jenner's middle stump going 20 yards back out the ground. Those of us who play the sort of cricket that we three have played over the years can't begin to imagine, yeah. Chris. I remember Pat Pocock is local, and his boy was at the grammar school with us, and I remember Pat coming in to do a bit of bowling in our indoor nets, short lanes anyway, and somebody said to me, "Blimey, he's quicker than the quick bowlers we play against." And, you know, that was Percy just sending them down a bit. And absolutely true. Must have been pretty daunting. And what about the acceptance angle? What I can't really remember back then. Was there a fairly established England core, or was it very much mobile?
There was a core of the main players. Obviously Ian Botham was... there, Bob Willis, Alan Knott was keeping, Derek Underwood. So there was Mike Hendrick, David Gower is obviously established. But this had come out fairly quickly. I mean, with Packer, you now had the Packer players coming back into the England sides. Bob Warmer was playing. But there were, over that sort of summer, there were quite a few changes, because obviously the West Indies were... You know, incredible side. Pete Willie got his usual recall to face the West Indies, as he likes to remind people, because he was a good player of quick bowling and used to be miffed that he never got picked to play India or whatever. Yeah. But so there was a core, but there were people like myself. I played two games of that series. Brian Rose then got called in, and then people like Bill Athey were around, Wayne Larkins.
Yeah.
So there was I think a lot happened in those days. You know, the peripheral players changed quite a lot.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really till Duncan Fletcher came along that things really started to, you know, people were given a longer go.
Was Will two-eyed at that stage, as he was later in his career? I can't remember.
Yeah, he was.
And that worked against quick bowling.
But when he got on the front foot, he turned round into the ball, so it was only a... starting position. Derek Rounder was around, fabulous player, and people used to say, oh, not fellow players or coaches, but people always used to say, why does he move around the crease? But at the point of delivery again, he was in perfect position.
That's the point, isn't it? It's the same with Jack Russell. He was the same. Well, he developed that over the years, that same stance where he was like a crab, and then but at the point the ball was bowled, He was in the correct position.
Well, you wouldn't have got Derek Randall to stand still anyway, so he had to be doing some movement.
Shivna Ryan, who?
Yes, well,
very much so. Yeah, it's all old times, long time ago. You mentioned Surrey and Chris. Let's move on to the game I really wanted to talk about, which is Old Trafford in Botham's Ashes, and you know, people talk about. Bob Willis, the High Chief Justice, and his 8-for at Leeds, and obviously Botham's heroics, which were, to me, genuinely heroic. And people always say that 118 was a far better and purer innings than the 149 at Leeds, which turned the game and turned the series. People don't always recall that, if my stats are right, CJ Tavares got a 60 and a 70 in that match, batted for 700 minutes, which is more than some England batsmen these days bat in a flipping season, and you were there at the other end through the whole of that Ian Botham 118. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was an amazing experience. It's the one experience that stands out for me in my career, my favourite day, or favourite 2 hours, if you like to put it like that. I mean, the game was evenly poised. I mean, clearly Australia was shell-shocked. We got bowled out relatively cheaply in our first innings, and they obviously decided they were going to come in and try and be aggressive and play shots, and they got out. So by the time we got to the Saturday morning, things were fairly even, and then Boycott and myself managed to bore everyone to death. This is a full house, I have to tell you, and we bored everyone to death before lunch, and then there was a bit of a collapse. And the moment Ian Botham walked on the pitch, the atmosphere just changed amazingly. It just became electric. And one of the things about Ian, his best knocks, he used to play himself in. You know, he scratched around for a bit. And it wasn't till the second new ball was taken that he just absolutely unleashed. And one shot I remember was that Terry Alderman dropped a ball short, and it was like a rifle being shot. I mean, and it just went flat for six. And I'm not normally sort of emotional, but towards the end of the innings, I felt, you know, almost some tears coming up, because I just realised this was just incredible. And, you know, just to be at the other end, I think, you know, was worth everything that had gone before, you know, and just be part of that.
I think his performance in 1981 is the single thing that stands out in the whole of my cricketing life, and has become the stuff of myth and legend. And it's all true. It's not really myth or legend at all. And, you know, from the nadir of Lords and getting out for zero and Breers coming back, the whole thing, quite extraordinary. But I wouldn't want anybody listening tonight to forget that you were at the other end throughout that, and that you batted 700 and odd minutes, whatever it was, in that test match. Let me just ask you, because I expect the listeners will want me to ask you, even though I don't really want to. You were by nature a fairly free-scoring cricketer. In Test cricket, did you make a conscious effort to follow in Geoffrey's footsteps and be the glue that held it together, or was that a matter of instruction?
No, it's a matter of chance, actually. I mean, I think what I realised was that I was playing probably at the very sort of edge of my ability, and particularly sort of mental ability. And so therefore I was sort of playing within myself. And the thing was, once I started playing like that, they were quite happy for me to carry on, because I was very lucky. I had a side, certainly when I started, I went in three, Gooch and Boycott had opened. So similarly, I batted the other end when Gooch scored 100 against the West Indies at Lords. You know, you had Gower coming in, the second year. Alan Lamb was coming in, Gatting, Botham, Randall. So in a sense, I could play that way. And it was, I knew from my own experience, it was much easier to play freely if someone at the other end wasn't getting out. But I really was at the sort of limit of my sort of mental and physical powers, if you like. And although I broke out on one or two occasions, you know, that was more the exception than the norm. But people appreciated, you know, it worked in that setup, but it wouldn't work in other setups.
I've just a couple more questions, Chris, because time inevitably flies when a discussion is as interesting as this one. So very quickly, if we may, what was it like touring India in those days? And did you enjoy your final period of your career when you went down to Somerset?
In terms of India, I mean, again, I was very naive. I mean, I grew up in Sevenoaks, touring school teams in those days. I mean, it was exciting going down to Devon on a school tour or a club tour, or going north of Watford to play county cricket, to me. So I'd never been abroad, and certainly wasn't prepared for the level of poverty that you're immediately confronted with when you landed at what was then Bombay Airport. So it was a real shock. And it took me 2 weeks to really sort of gain the confidence. And in the end, I used to, because I was quite happy to go out and sort of visit places. I remember hiring one of those funny little taxis and going in Bangalore just to go and look at some old forts, you know, just for something to do on a afternoon when we weren't training. But certainly in terms of my upbringing, it was just completely different, and took a lot of getting used to. And the other problem was, in the series we went 1-0 down in the first test, and after that the wickets were so flat, probably it was the most boring cricket I've ever played. You know, it was just we bat one innings, you bat one innings, and that was it.
Got your highest test score at Delhi, though.
Yeah.
So, it's a small compensations. And am I right that you arrived at Somerset in the aftermath of all the upheaval?
Yeah, I arrived in 89, and the sackings and the resignations happened in 86. So, but there was, a lot of sort of residual ill feeling between certain ex-players and two current players. But also amongst the supporters, it was still, I think, quite a bit of taste, because people loved Richard Garner, and their sacking then led to Ian going off to Worcester. So, it was a difficult time to go, and the side was obviously not nearly as strong. And it didn't really start to look up again till my last year, when Andy Caddick was first available and we had Mushtaq Ahmed, and suddenly we were bowling sides out, which we just couldn't do on the Taunton wicket, certainly up to then.
We could go on for so much longer, but we must take an ad break now, gentlemen. And when we come back, I'll get Tim to broaden things out. We must talk about what's gone on today in England's 1,000th Test match. And I know there are lots of other things on the agenda.
Well, welcome back to On the Front Foot, myself and David Jay. We have Chris Tavaray and Jim Grant in the studio with us, and given what's been going on today at Edgbaston, I guess we ought to touch on the test. What are your thoughts, chaps, on what's happened today?
It's been an amazing day's cricket, or 2 days cricket. I mean, it's, people will complain about technique and patience or lack of, but low scoring games make for some of the best games that you can watch. And I think one of the things that today demonstrated is that you can have an hour of not much happening, and then suddenly two or three wickets will fall and there'll be intense emotion amongst the crowd and the players, and then it will calm down and then there'll be a sudden flurry of wickets again. And I think this is what people who like Test cricket think is so great about it, is that it's this constant sort of up and down.
Yeah, it's that ebb and flow, isn't it? It's that balance, that sort of sense of a game. You can see a game evolving and edging one way or another, and that the last session with Kohli sort of farming the strike, and how was that being managed tactically by Root and the England bowlers was utterly compelling. They put on 50 and what's his face called one.
Yeah.
The chap at the other end, the bowler, and you thought all the kind of conundrums of that, all the question marks that you have to face as a captain in that. You've got to be flexible and inventive. You've got to coming to that from having seen a couple of 2020 games at Lord's in the last few weeks, it is that complexity and that richness and subtlety of the test game that scores for people like me. The 2020 game feels so formulaic.
Yeah,
everything is a kind of pattern, and it's a blueprint, and batsmen are simply attacking and bowlers are defending, and although there's lots of excitement and people hit sixes all the time, it's not like both of them hitting sixes at Old Trafford in that game situation, because of the risk, because of the danger, because of the value that there is on somebody counter-attacking in that way within the context of the game. And
There was talk on Test Match Special when I was listening on the way to the studio tonight that the innings by Kohli's day was possibly one of the best Test innings there.
It was absolutely magnificent. I mean, he got away with it. We dropped him a couple of times, didn't we? 21 in the 50s. But he absolutely didn't let that put him off. He capitalised on it, and the way he started to take the game, well, not quite away from England, obviously, but to get them back into the game, I thought was brilliant. Really.
Yeah. I mean, I think he certainly brought India back in with a chance now in the Test. I mean, I think the nearest scorer to Kohli was on 26, I think, on the scorecard. So, it was an incredible effort really all round there.
And they were talking about, in the middle of his innings, he was put under the most severe pressure. We were only listening to it on the radio, but when Stokes was bowling, you know, that was probably, from what I gather, the most exciting period of the day, because he was playing and missing but not getting flustered, and you know, he reaped the rewards once he got through that, and the ball stopped doing so much again. So,
and the personal duel with Anderson, you know, that sort of set that, that person, you know, that, that test match has these little gladiatorial combats within it, doesn't it, you know, and the history of him, you know, started today, he had an average of, I think, 13 in tests in this country. You know,
I think they said
he's got that massive sort of kind of burden going in of the pressure that, you know, he's supposed, he is, you know, probably at the moment the greatest batsman in the world, but he hasn't delivered in English conditions, and it swung, and he got a, he got a, you know, 150 on a swinging pitch.
And it also shows you need a bit of luck. He was dropped twice.
We've all dropped chances, haven't we? But you just have the impression that David Milan, when Kohli was on 21, might be a very, very significant mischance indeed.
It might be,
But also, so was the run out of Joe Root the day before.
Well, yes, that was...
But again, that was... I mean, you look at that, and it angers me so much that these test players... have the minds. I appreciate that they have to try and entertain, and they play, it's a different game now, but why on earth were they looking to take two? Why did Bairstow call two there? He clearly wanted to run two, he had nothing else in his mind. What? I just don't understand that mentality.
This is 22nd run out that he's been involved in as an England player in not a very long career.
You know,
so he's got a bit of a track record.
We're crying out for someone who can bat and stay there. I mean, Chris, you sell yourself way too short, because what price England to have a player like you today? I mean, we England would be infinitely better if we had somebody who could come in and just stay there and bat, but they just don't have that mindset anymore.
Well, I think what you see is, you know, the first game of a series can be really tense, and I think what we've seen in a few series now is that they get a bit agitated and try and go out and be dominant, and suddenly find they lose the first test. And funnily enough, the first game in Brisbane, when there was a key run out to Vince, you know, changed the match completely there. And it's as though there's a sort of anxiety, which there always is at the start of a series.
Did you experience that when you used to bat? And were you able to block that out when you went out there so that you could bat for lengthy periods of time?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about being in the zone and focusing on what you're trying to do. And I think the expectations of 40 years ago very different to what they are now. I mean, it was very interesting listening to Ravi Papara last night talking about, you just have to accept this is the way the game is played. And although it's frustrating, it does create some fantastic cricket. There's always a result. There's always this ebb and flow. There are so few draws. You know, it's although I don't think they do it because it's entertaining, but I think the way one day cricket has changed perspectives of what you can and can't do, you know, they want to dominate more, and it's understandable. And when it goes well, they get 450, 500, and it'll be brilliant. And you just have to accept days where, you know, I think the run out was because probably there was a lot of anxiety, and, you know, they had actually played really well in the morning. They'd played old-fashioned cricket. But Bairstow's not that sort of player who wants to be leaving a lot of balls, you know. He wants to dominate the running to upset the opposition, and it just went wrong.
I mean, it does feel, doesn't it, like that we have let them off the hook, given that we were bowled out for 287, I think, in the first innings. You think, well, that's not a good enough score to have India where we had them, and to let them off the hook so that we're level pretty much now. It does feel like, you know, it's game on now.
But have we let them off the hook? I mean, they have one brilliant player. I mean, he's the most outstanding batsman in the world today. And, yeah, he gave a couple of chances, but as Dave said, they're going to get dropped occasionally. And
Ashwin's certainly the best spinner in the match.
Well, I would imagine he must be getting into their heads, the England batsman now, thinking that he took four wickets in the first innings and he's going to come back out.
Well, and Cook's dismissal was carbon copy.
We only heard about that because we were here already. We just heard on the grapevine about
it
that.
It was almost like a replay.
Interestingly, and Tav was talking just now about changing attitudes and so on and so forth. Seems to me, being brutally frank from a great distance and not being a great player myself, that Alistair Cook is almost the last who can construct a Chris Taveray, Jeff Boycott, Kenny Barrington type of innings. And it just seems to me that he is increasingly looking likely to slide down the tubes on his way out.
It does feel that way. I mean, there was the great double hundred in Australia. That's possibly the only time he's looked likely to pass 50 in quite a few innings now.
Let alone three figures. So there it is. I just drawing a couple of strands together from this side. I mean, Chris says when the Express Yourself goes well, it goes really well. I'll be quite honest with you, looking back to that Australian series, I don't want to see anybody score 480 in a 50-over game. That's a massacre. That's not competitive. Mm. And yet, the only time I really sat and watched, time obviously to watch nowadays, the only time I really watched any of that series, to say I sat and watched it, was when England were 114 for 8 at the Oval, and Butler got them over the line in that last OD, and that was edge of the seat stuff.
Well, of course, limited overs cricket does throw up these amazing finishes, but they it is formulaic. There are too many of them, I think, and they don't linger in the memory in the way that we talk about the way Test match cricket does. For me, anyway, that's a personal thing. What did we make of the fact that they didn't sell out? There was quite a thing. It became a little bit of a media story, didn't it? That they didn't sell out, and there was the ECB sort of said, "Well, we're a bit worried about Test cricket now," and that boiled my blood, because it was your decision to take it off terrestrial television. So why are you then surprised when people don't turn up to buy tickets for it outside of London?
And it's Edgbaston on a Wednesday.
And a Wednesday? Why is it
on a Wednesday? There was a lot of slightly glib, slightly flip comment on Sky. And don't misunderstand me, I really like the Sky commentary. And I think the lady commentators have added again something to that, doing work on the men's matches as well. But there was this slightly flip stuff all through the T20 and the ODIs about these are effectively home matches for India, Edgbaston probably more than any. If I look at the people I know well from the subcontinent, I suspect that work ethic may come before going to a Test match on a Wednesday morning.
Possibly, yeah.
I imagine a Wednesday. I can imagine that ECB is saying, well, you can get 3-4 days of corporate hospitality.
Yeah.
If you start on a Thursday, you'll only get 2 days, and the game will be over by the Monday anyway.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, I doubt whether the ordinary tickets are cheap. I've got two Compton Stand tickets for the first day of the Lord's Test, £100 a pop. It's not cheap to go and watch a day of Test cricket anymore. There's no system like there used to be at Lord's where the kids could just go and sit on the grass for next to nothing.
No.
There isn't a sense of wanting to bring people into the game in that way. It's got pound signs rolling around.
Well, let's be honest, we're in August. We've got the first Test against India in August. We haven't had Test cricket for a month. I mean, when did that happen, that in a summer there's no Test cricket going on for weeks on end, because there's this relentless one days and T20s. It's taken over from Test cricket.
I read somewhere that the first T20 blast game that Sussex played at home was the first game of cricket at Hove for a month, and that was something like the 13th of July. And lovely place like Hove as well, which lends itself to festival. Whether that meant first class cricket or List One cricket, I'm not quite clear, but it does make you think. Can I chuck, we touched on this and Indian home games, and we haven't mentioned Yorkshire. What about Adil Rashid and Red Bull cricket?
I'm quite comfortable with it, to be honest. I mean, I think he's given a lot of service to Yorkshire. It's not as though he's just new to the game, broken into the England side and said, I'm not going to play for Yorkshire. I mean, he's put a lot of service in, a lot of hours into his cricket. And the fact of the matter is, I think as a lot of people recognise, there aren't great resources in the spin department. Leach probably was the only one being considered as being a possibility, but I think when you go in against sides like India, who are such good players of spin, you've got to go in with experience, and I suspect that at some stage they'll play Ali as well. And Leach hasn't played much cricket this year because of injuries, so, and Bess is in the second 11 at Somerset. So I think given how important it was to have an experienced spinner, you know, I think it was probably right on reflection that he was picked. What's going on at Yorkshire? I think it's been suggested there maybe was something bubbling up underneath that actually is the problem, and I don't like this sort of public sort of argument going on. Go into a room and sort it out. I mean, Ed Smith said Rashid's got to play county cricket again if he's going to be considered in the future.
Martin Moxon made the point that they'd signed a white ball contract with Rashid, and now Rashid's playing red ball cricket for England, and Yorkshire are missing out on him playing white ball cricket. So I guess from his point of view, he's got a point.
But who comes first, England or Yorkshire?
Yeah.
You know, Yorkshire get a rough deal because they do provide a lot of England players, but the core of the game is England.
Yeah.
You know,
slightly begs the question, though, why England dropped him in the first place, though, isn't it? And surely that, I mean, I don't know what's going on at Yorkshire, but one sense at the time, the fact that he'd been left out of the England team and didn't go and to play in the Test side in Australia had something to do with his disillusionment.
He always bowled well. I thought he was a good batsman as well, could come in at number 8 or 9 and always played well with the bat. It was an odd decision that he was sort of dropped out of the setup initially.
It was strange,
especially considering, as you say, we're not exactly over blessed with spinners of that quality, and yet these guys are almost being pushed to the point where they're saying, well, forget it, I'm going to play white ball cricket.
Yeah, but they found themselves in a bit of a bind with this Test series, as you were just explaining, Chris, really, in terms of needing a spinner and preferably an experienced one against very good players of spin. But I felt for a long time, and I think we might have discussed this last time I was on, that I've said that the England setup is prioritising the one-day team.
Yeah.
Over the Test team, and has been for some time, with the aim of the big showpiece,
the World Cup,
wanting to win the World Cup on home turf. That seems to be the big, suddenly has become the big target. And I think you know, you saw it to a certain extent with the way the Australian tour panned out. You know, you've got players coming in to play one day. Teams. I mean, we couldn't lay a bat on you know, Stark and whatever in the Test series, and then, you know, as soon as the one day start, Roy turns up and he's kind of ramp shotting him over, you know, and scoring. And you think, well, hang on a minute, if you can do that with a why isn't he in the frame to open a problem position? Why isn't he in the frame to open?
Well, David and I have had this conversation.
Why is Hales
many
not
times?
On the Test team?
I think, you know, going back to school cricket, I mean, I can remember H again looking at somebody and saying, well, if he can go in at 11:30 and get you 30 by 12 o'clock, David, he's done a good job, you know. And if Jason Roy does that, what, 4 times out of 10 innings, then why not let me throw in the perennial name at this point, which is Rory Burns? I mean, what has he got to do?
Yeah.
I know he was in the Lions and perhaps skipped the Lions and didn't seize his opportunity, but he looks like a quality county batsman, and he's local, City Freemans and Bansters.
It's odd, isn't it, that players like that are not getting a look in.
And it seems, I mean, just talking about the emphasis on the one-day game, I mean, it's so short-sighted that they're playing all these county games in April, early May and September, and yet that's where the next generation of Test players are coming, and particularly spinners. I mean, they should have been bowling hundreds of overs this last sort of 6 weeks as the wickets have got really dry, and as you could see at Edgbaston, it looked a good wicket, but it was turning. And you know, if money is Test cricket and you want to have a successful team, you've got to prioritise county championship more to develop the players.
In answer to Jim's kite flown earlier on about money, 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 you don't do it around Test cricket, nor even ODIs. You invent something called the 100, which nobody yet knows exactly what it's going to constitute or how it's going to be together. Everything that comes out of the ECB seems to be even more ridiculous than the previous utterance. They're talking about blocks of 12 balls and 10 overs from one at either.
They seem to be chasing an audience that is either not there, or if it is there, it's a kind of new audience. And the assumption that somehow this new thing they're going to come up is going to be some sort of gateway drug to the hard stuff of Test cricket. I just don't think that's true. No. I just don't think those people are going to be interested in it. It's a bit separate. It's a different game.
The new audience is already watching The Blast and the KSL. Yes. That is the new audience.
Or not watching it. I mean, yeah. I don't know how if you've been to a 2020 game recently, but call me old fashioned, and Chris, you know I am old fashioned, but. So many of the sort of niceties, the etiquette of watching cricket has gone out of the window. Mm. People walk past your seat in the middle of an over with beer all over the place. There is no sense. John Murray, who passed away, it was an absolute disaster that their attempted. It was the game against Hampshire. He went up on the big screen. There was a nice spiel about, but they did it at the break, at the interval break. Everyone just got up and left. In my section of the Compton stand, when they said, "Let's stand and applaud," I was the only person within visible sight who stood and applauded. Mm. People just ignored it. They didn't even know who he was. No sense. It goes back to your putting the photographs up on the wall. We are losing a sense of the history and the traditions of the game. I worry about it.
JT Murray, it all went horribly wrong against the 1966 West Indians, and for the last test, they appointed Closey as captain. Tom Graveney made 160-odd. JT made 112 coming in at number 9. They put on 200 and God knows how many. Higgs and Snow made 100 for the last wicket, and Sobers was out for 0, caught at short leg by Close. JT Murray, marvellous chap.
Yeah.
And but as you say, who would know?
So disrespectful. It was really disappointing.
Who would know? Gentlemen, we could fill another 2 hours very easily, but I'm afraid our time is almost up. Jim, it's always a pleasure. We hope we'll have you back as a regular pundit soon. Chris Taveray of Kent, Somerset and England, it's been a delight and a pleasure and a privilege to have you. There's so much more that we could have talked about, but I do hope at least that you've enjoyed your time with us here at Susie 103.4.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you so much for coming, and Tim, I'll see you in September. And that was the August edition of On the Front Foot here at Susie 103.4. Let me repeat, what a pleasure and a privilege it's been to have our first Test cricketer as a full-time guest on the show. And we really could have gone on for another couple of hours. There are aspects of Chris Taveray's many cricketing experiences that we haven't even touched on, but it's been fascinating to touch on those that we have covered this evening. We'll be back on the second Thursday of September. Always a pleasure to have Jim Grant with us. Tim works very, very hard to put these shows together, and lots goes on below the waterline. That's it for this edition.